This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its Board of Directors, Associate Station Manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with attorney Jonathan Martinez on the continuing topic of supported decision-making. But first, disability news for the week of September 6, 2021. The U.S. Department of Education is opening investigations in five states where officials say limiting school mask mandates may violate federal laws that prohibit discrimination against students with disabilities. The Office for Civil Rights sent letters this last week to officials in Iowa, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Utah, informing them of the investigations to examine whether each state is complying with Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. Section 504 guarantees students with disabilities the right to a free, appropriate public education to be provided alongside their peers without disabilities to the maximum extent appropriate. The ADA bars public entities such as school systems from discriminating against people with disabilities. At the center of the investigation are a variety of state actions to keep schools from requiring universal masking to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Without masking requirements, many parents of students with disabilities and those with medical conditions who are at risk of severe illness from the coronavirus are hesitant to send their children to school in person. The situation is especially tense since students with disabilities are among those who have struggled with remote education during the pandemic. Said Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona, quote, "The department has heard from parents across the country, particularly parents of students with disabilities and with underlying medical conditions, about how state bans on universal indoor masking are putting their children at risk and preventing them from accessing in-person learning equally. It's simply unacceptable that state leaders are putting politics over the health and education of the students they took an oath to serve. The department will fight to protect every student's right to access in-person learning safely and the rights of local educators to put in place policies that allow all students to return to the classroom full-time in person safely this fall," end quote. The letter states that the Education Department is concerned that their policies may be preventing schools from meeting their legal obligations not to discriminate based on disability and from providing an equal educational opportunity to students with disabilities who are at heightened risk of severe illness from COVID-19. Currently, the Education Department is not investigating Florida, Texas, Arkansas, or Arizona because mask mandate bans in those states are not being enforced due to a court order or other state actions. The agency said it will monitor those situations and is prepared to take action if circumstances change. Already, families in Florida, Texas, South Carolina, and Tennessee have filed suit, alleging that the mask mandate restrictions violate disability rights. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that school require everyone age 2 and older to wear face masks, whether or not they are vaccinated. A doctor in the UK has become a social media hero after writing a letter to a local official after his patient's application for a disabled parking badge was rejected. The patient, a special constable for the UK police, lost his lower right leg in 2018 after he was hit by a car. In the UK, people can apply for what's called a blue badge, which allows them to park their vehicles closer to their destination for ease of access. The government says that people may be eligible for a badge for a variety of reasons, including if they have difficulties walking. Local councils then decide whether or not someone is eligible for one of the badges based on evidence provided. When the man applied to his local council to have his blue badge renewed, he was told he would have to supply more evidence of his disability in order to qualify. He then approached his doctor to discuss the issue, who decided to compose a letter to the council insisting that his patient's leg had not grown back. The doctor wrote, quote, "I was most surprised to be asked for a statement of fact regarding my patient's disability. I can assure you that he has indeed had a traumatic amputation of his right lower leg in a road traffic accident. It is, of course, unlikely that this situation will change unless medical science allows us to regrow a new leg for him," end quote. The blue badge was renewed. And finally, service dogs made headlines in Japan last month when they strutted alongside visually impaired athletes on the Israeli team, tails wagging, during the Tokyo Paralympics opening ceremony. The images and videos were a hit on social media, where Japanese users gushed over the pups with surprise and admiration. For Japan's disability advocates, the Tokyo Paralympics provides a global platform to raise awareness about the social stigma, barriers, and discrimination they face, similar to how the 1964 Tokyo Paralympics, the first in Asia, helped the Japanese public understand the needs of people with disabilities. Those who rely on four-legged partners say they hope the games will lead to greater acceptance of service dogs and other forms of assistance that empower them to live independently and stay healthy. Nearly two decades ago, the Japanese government passed the Assistance Dogs for Persons with Physical Disabilities Act of 2002 to certify service dogs and allow them to enter public facilities and transportation. But the use of service dogs remains rare in Japan, unlike in the U.S., where they are so common that people try to pass off their pets as service dogs to gain entry to more places or bring unusual animals as emotional support animals on airplanes. In general, dogs aren't tolerated in public settings in Japan. It can be hard for dog owners to rent apartments in Tokyo, and few restaurants allow people to bring their dogs. Many owners carry cleaning spray bottles to wipe down the sidewalk of their dog's feces. At the same time, many people push small dogs around in strollers and pamper them with designer brand clothing and accessories. It wasn't until Japan won the bid for the Paralympics in 2013 that many of the infrastructure and regulatory changes were made to make the country more accessible. Still, those updates haven't led to meaningful progress in cultural understanding, said Mark Bookman, an advocate for people with disabilities and a postdoctoral fellow at Tokyo College who studies the history of disability policy and activism. As the Paralympics came to a close this weekend, Tomoko Hashizumi of the Japan Service Dog Resource Center said she hopes that the spotlight on people with disabilities will help break down barriers. Hashizumi said, quote, "I think in Japan, people's understanding of disabilities is still very behind because people with disabilities weren't able to actively participate in society historically. Therefore, many people in the government that are having discussions for disabled people have never communicated or interacted with people with disabilities. So I think the Paralympics has been a real learning opportunity for them." And that's the news for this week.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Snooker on the door. Ain't nothing but a hound dog. Where's Snooker on the door? You can wire your tail. But I ain't gonna be a you.
And now I'm pleased to introduce my guest for the afternoon, Jonathan Martinez. I first heard Jonathan at a conference in Indianapolis specifically, in December, and was very impressed with his depth and breadth of knowledge and experience in discussing guardianship, which is something that people in my experience just kind of take for granted. So you may be familiar with the case of Jenny Hatch. Jonathan was one of the key players in her court case, and he'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, too. So welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Good evening, Vicki. Thanks so much for having me.
So why don't you start, just introduce yourself to the audience, let them know who you are and what your experience was, and maybe summarize a little bit of Jenny's case and how that was resolved.
Sure. I'm Jonathan Martinez. I'm the Senior Director for Law and Policy at the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University. Prior to that, I worked for a nonprofit called Quality Trust for Individuals with Disabilities. I've been practicing in disabilities law for 20 years and involved in issues like this my entire life. Jenny Hatch was someone I met in 2012. She is a pretty remarkable person. Jenny is, when I met her, she was 29 years old. She had been living in her own apartment. She had her own job for 5 years, paying her own taxes, living her own life, just like everyone else does. The only difference was Jenny had Down syndrome, so that when she got into a car accident, she found herself on the receiving end of a guardianship petition. Now, this was, again, a young woman who had graduated from high school, was active in political affairs, had a social life, went to her own church, and pretty much in the space of one half a day hearing, found herself in a group home, a segregated group home, where she wasn't allowed to go to her job or her church or see her friends, where her cell phone was taken away and her Facebook password was changed and her laptop was taken away. And if you wanted to see Jenny Hatch at that time, before I met her, you had to fill out a permission slip. You had to literally ask the guardians for permission to see her, and you had to agree that you would not talk to her about the guardianship case. So the first time I met Jenny, I kind of broke and entered. I walked in and was carrying a briefcase and gave a confident wave and said, "I'm here to see Jenny," and they let me through, and I offered my assistance to her. And she said she wanted me to be her attorney, and that started a one-year journey where, after a year of going to court and 6 days of trial, Jenny was freed from that guardianship simply because she, like everyone else, makes her own decision, or she has the ability to make her own decision. And she'd been doing that using something that we called supported decision-making. And we showed that Jenny used this method, even though it wasn't named that, to make her own decisions. What's supported decision-making? It's the way everyone makes decisions. Think about it. If you are going to the doctor and the doctor speaks jargon to you, it sounds like something you've never heard of before. You say, "Can you explain that to me like I'm a five-year-old?" If you go to the auto mechanic and the auto mechanic speaks jargon at you, you say, "Can you please help me understand what this is going on?" If you've got a friend you go to for advice, all of these things, you're using supported decision-making because you're getting the help you need to make the decisions you have to make. And we showed that Jenny, like everyone else, needs help, gets help, and when she got that help, she was able to make her own decisions. And after a year, the court agreed. And Jenny was the first person ever to defeat a guardianship petition in favor of supported decision-making. And I'm proud to say that since that time, she has been living free. She lives with her friends. She does what she wants. She's back at her job. And she's a frequent speaker around the country.
Who was the guardian for Jenny when that happened?
Initially, it was an agency called Jewish Family Services in Virginia. It then transferred to her parents.
And so, Jonathan, in most cases, in my experience, the idea of guardianship, the process of guardianship, starts very young, that parents are told as their kids are graduating or as they're turning 18 in school that they should just go ahead and do the paperwork and get guardianship. What's your argument against that for those families?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what happens by and large. We have been putting people under some form of guardianship for 2,000 years back to the Roman Empire. We have been assuming that people can't do things. We have been taking for granted that people with disabilities, just because they might need a little bit of help to do something, no different from you and I needing a little bit of help, can't do things. And that's such a strange thing, isn't it? That we judge people based upon what they cannot do. That we judge people based upon their limitations. You and I aren't judged that way. We are judged on what we can do. Did you take your job, ma'am, because you're bad at it? No, of course not. You limited the things that you can't do, and you accentuated the things you can. But for people with disabilities, it's the other way around. We don't look at strengths. We look at weaknesses. So we say from a young age to a parent with a child with disabilities, you're going to need to become this child's guardian. So at age 18, and young adults, 18, are the fastest growing people with under guardianship, we take away rights. There are studies after studies that say that 90% or more of guardianships are full or plenary, even though that just about every state law says that guardianships should be limited to just those areas where people can't manage themselves or make their own decisions. We are finding the vast majority take away all rights. One Congressman Claude Pepper, when he studied this, said that the average ward has fewer rights than the average convicted felon. Think about that for a second. Just because you have a disability, you have less rights than a person in prison. And you know what? That's what we see time and again. Now, you ask me my argument against guardianship. I've got an easy one for you. We have 40 years of studies, 40 years, going back to the 70s, finding that when people with disabilities have more control over their lives, or more self-determination is the clinical phrase, they have better lives. People with disabilities who have more self-determination are more likely to be employed, independent, healthier, safer, integrated into their community, and more likely to manage their own funds and affairs. I'll give you a very recent example to back that up. Recently, there was a national study called the National Core Indicator Study. Now, the National Core Indicator Study is what I call an apples-to-apples study. It looks at people of similar abilities and limitations. They even used the old-fashioned terminology of mild, moderate, and severe disabilities. Now, this study looked at people's quality of life, how they lived their life over a number of different variables. One of the variables they looked at was whether people had a guardian or not. And across the country and across the board, including in Illinois, people who did not have guardians were more likely to be employed, independent, more likely to practice the religion of their choice, more likely to have friends other than paid staff, more likely to socialize and live in the community than people of similar abilities and limitations who had guardians. So what I say is this. I'm not here to tell any person, any family member, any parent whether or not they should seek guardianship. That is an intensely personal decision. I would never tell someone what to do if I didn't know them or knew their situation. But what I can give people is information. I can give them information like I just gave them. I can give them more tools for their toolbox. And I can say this. Guardianship's always going to be there. It's always going to be an option. Why should we rush into it? Why shouldn't we try something else first? The National Guardianship Association, for example, the NGA, is an organization made up of guardians, by guardians, for guardians. They do a code of ethics for guardians. They do trainings for guardians. They certify guardians. There is no one more invested in guardianship than the NGA. You know what the NGA says? They say, before trying guardianship, try something else first. Try something like supported decision-making. Try something to enhance people's self-determination, to see if that works. And if it does, great. If it doesn't, try something else. If nothing works, guardianship will always be there, and it will always be an option.
So let's talk a little bit more about the idea of supported decision-making, and how can families implement that model rather than going through the legal hoops?
Mm-hmm. Well, supported decision-making can be as formal or as informal as people want. The beautiful thing about it is it's not one size fits all. When I give presentations around the country, I always say, if you ever hear someone say, I have an app for you, I have a book for you, I have the one way to do supported decision-making, run away and run away fast. Because supported decision-making is individualized to each person. We look for each person's specific abilities, their preferences, what they need to make their own decisions, and we try to implement that. Some people just need informal advice, a listening ear, someone to bounce ideas off of. Some people can use it through a power of attorney where they say, I am going to work with you for financial issues and you for medical issues and you for lifestyle issues, where they pick people out and they specify how they're going to work together. Some people create micro boards or circles of support that meet regularly to discuss the person's life and the person's needs and affairs to help the person make decisions. What I say is this, supported decision making is less a method than a mindset. It is a paradigm, not a process. And here's what I mean. If we start here by saying that everybody out there has the right to make their own choices to the maximum of their ability. If we start with that commitment, and that's an easy commitment to make, that's just the Declaration of Independence, isn't it? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are endowed with rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If we start there, then the second thing is easy. We can say, I have this right, and I have the right to get help to exercise my right to make choices without giving up that right. I can get help, just like you and I get help. And if we take those two things as given, the third one's even easier, and it goes like this. There are as many ways to give and receive help as there are people. So I always say this. Before seeking guardianship, ask a really important question. What else have you tried? What else have you tried to empower this person, to enable this person to exercise self-determination? What have we done? And there's a million ways to do it. You can start in school, where you ask the school to implement self-determination goals and work together through IDEA and IEP planning and transition planning. You can go through vocational rehabilitation as you get older to work on job-based decision-making skills. You can go through Medicaid waiver programs for activities of daily living that include self-determination. All of these are potential avenues. And if you need more information about ways to implement that, please go to www.supporteddecisionmaking.org. That is the website of the National Resource Center for Supported Decision Making, an organization I'm the co-project director of. We've got resources, we have research library, we have model forms that you can use and implement and individualize for the people in your lives. Like I said, one size does not fit all, but one commitment can fit everyone, and that's this. Everyone has the right to make choices to the maximum of their ability. It is on us to help them empower that.
A little earlier, you referred to a study that people who do not have guardians have a better quality of life. And why do you suppose that is? Did they address that?
The study itself, the National Core Indicators, is very clear that they are a correlative study, which meant that the people without guardians were correlated with having better life outcomes. They did not say that not having a guardian caused the better life outcomes. But if you want my personal theory on it,
it's this.
We know that more self-determination equals better quality of life. That has been proven through research time and again. So people who have more control over their lives have better life outcomes. We have shown that for decades. Now, if you are making your own decisions, if you don't have a guardian making decisions for you, it stands to reason that you have more control over your life. So to me, it's relatively, my feeling is that it's A plus B equals C arithmetic. If I'm making my own decisions, I have more control over my life. And we know that having more control over one's life is a better life outcome. Currently, the National Resource Center, we're actually doing some research to try to prove that empirically. But I think theoretically, it makes a lot of sense.
And then the last question I want to ask you is, what about people who have already gone through this process and gotten guardianship over their family member? Is there any recourse if they're thinking, well, gosh, maybe I shouldn't have done this? Is there something I can do to change it?
Yes, there are. Every state has a process for what is often called restoration or getting out of guardianship. Generally, what's needed to be proven is that the guardianship is no longer necessary or that the issues that led to the guardianship are no longer existing. Now, this is not easy. I always say the best way to avoid guardianship is not to get in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But I just recently came through the first case in Washington, D.C., where a person got out of a guardianship. Really briefly, this was a young man with disabilities who, when he turned 18, his parents were told, you must get guardianship over your child if you want to get services. And they said, like so many parents, we don't want to do this. We don't want to. We have raised Ryan, his name is. To be independent. And we always want to support Ryan. And they were told, no, you must get guardianship. So reluctantly, they did. About 7 years later, they said, this is silly. He doesn't need a guardian. We've been supporting him his whole life. And what if we die before him? He'll have a stranger as his guardian. So they went back to the court. And they said to the court, please remove us as guardian. Ryan doesn't need it. He can do these things through a power of attorney. You know what the court said? The court said, well, if you don't want to be his guardians, I can find someone else. So they retreated, and they stayed as guardian until after Jenny's case, they found me. And we spent a year putting a case together, getting experts together, showing that Ryan can and does make his own decisions, that like Jenny, he uses supported decision-making, and like Jenny, he didn't call it that, but it was the same thing. He worked with his family and his friends to make decisions over his life. And we went to court in October, and the judge said, you're a free man. You can make the decisions you need to make like you've been doing your whole life. If you want to do a power of attorney, that's your choice. But he terminated the guardianship in favor of Ryan's supported decision-making relationships, the first person in Washington, D.C. to do so. So you can get out. What I tell people is it can happen. The best way out is not to get in. But if you get in, you know, I tell parents, don't feel guilty if you were pushed into this. It's not your fault if you trusted somebody who you trust. But we can take steps to help people be more independent if that's the situation. We can move forward. We can help people gain the self-determination that equals a better life. Not every case is the same, but we know, as a general rule, that self-determination is a far better thing than dependence.
And we take the advice of those professionals in education who really don't know the impact long-term.
Yes, it's a confusing and I would say scary thing. I was part of a study last year that found that the number one referral source for guardianship across the country is school. Mm-hmm. More than lawyers, more than doctors, more than family, more than friends, school. Just recently, the federal government put out a transition guide for schools that is the first time they have identified supported decision-making as a viable option to guardianship and essentially told parents that you don't have to do this. You shouldn't feel like you have to be pushed into guardianship. There are other options. And again, I'll say sometimes guardianship is appropriate. I'm not here to say there should never be a guardian, but I am here to tell parents there are options and there is information, and you should try every tool in your box.
You want to give that website one more time before we run out of time?
Sure. www.supporteddecisionmaking.org.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Jonathan Martinez, and I look forward to hearing you more on this topic maybe in the future.
It's been my pleasure, Vicki. Thank you so much.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'll stand my ground. Won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Hey, have you ever considered hosting a show of your own on WEFT, or are you a former WEFT airshifter itching to get back on the air? You're in luck because WEFT currently has openings in our on-air schedule. Whether you have time for a weekly, bi-weekly, or once-a-month commitment, we're happy to discuss the available options and possibilities with you. WEFT's next airshifter training program rotation will begin with online classroom training on Tuesday, October 5th. Visit WEFT's homepage at weft.org. Scroll down the page to the Airshifter Training section where you'll find the link to the training application. Once you complete that, email your application to airshiftertraining@weft.org or drop it off at the station at 113 North Market Street, Champaign. Any questions regarding training or available airshifts may be forwarded to airshiftertraining@weft.org or programming@weft.org, or you can just leave a message at 217-359-9600. 9338. We look forward to hearing from you soon. And now here is today's episode of Food Sleuth Radio.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth.